ॐ सत्सङ्करणे विष्णुयामसेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षतीर्यचक्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैः सृष्टुवागुं सत्यमिन्दिः यशेम देवहितन्यतायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति न पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तर्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। सप्रमा सशिवः सेन्द्रः शिव
What number?
I don't know. That's the problem. We had three different books. They all have different numbers. Let me see yours. Let me see yours. Oh.
118.
Yeah. 118 in this book. Okay, but I need this one. Let me see yours then. No, let me see your other one you've got. That one. Yeah. 118 in the book. And then in this handout, it's number 8. Page 118 in your book. Number 8 in this. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, number 8. And in mine, it's totally different. Okay, so repeat after me. Saprama Sashivaha. Saprama Sashivaha. Saindraha. Saoksharaha. Paramaha Swarat. Saeva Vishnahu. Sapranaha. Sakalo Agnihi, Sachandramaha. Okay, this says Saha Brahma, breaking the Sandhi. Saha Brahma, Saha Shivaha, Saha Sa Indraha. It should say, it says Saindraha, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder where they got that, Sandhi. Should say Saha Indraha, Saha Aksharaha, Paramaha Swarat, Saha Eva Vishnuhu, Saha Pranaha, Saha Kalaha, Agnihi, Saha Chandramaha. Okay. This is after having said, after spending this time teaching this meditation, in the end he says, having done this jatwa, having done this meditation, he says, munihi gachati, the muni, the one who's meditating, that one goes to bhutayonim. Bhutayonim means that being which is the yoni, the very cause of all of this. Of bhutas are all this, everything that has come into being. The yoni is the womb of that, the very source of that. So the one who has understood the Atma, the self, goes to that Bhuta yoni, which is samasta sakshinam, which is the witness of everything. So I'm going to relate a lot of this to the meditation that we did today. So samasti sakshinam, one who is the witness of everything. Tamasaha parastat, the one who is beyond darkness, beyond ignorance, that meditator, the one who's meditating, goes to that. Means by going to that, means simply, it's not a matter of travel. It means there's an identity shift. There's an identity shift between the ahankara, your sense of I being identified with the body, mind, sense organs, the one who's in the meadow, right? The one who's identified with the body and mind and sense organs, that's body, mind, sense organs, that's sitting in the room, that ahankara, that I notion, that takes my being, which is in fact the cause of everything, the very being of everything, and takes it, the mind, this body, mind, sense organs, identifies myself with it. My mind and the I thought, which is just a thought, it says I, this conscious being that I am, is this body. I, this me, is the mind. I am this thought. I am happy. I am sad. I am you know, agitated, or I am just my mind, or I am this physical body, or I am a woman, or I am a man, or I am, you know, tall or short, or 15 or 30 or 40 or 50, 60. It's all identification with what we call the upadhi, right? The one who knows goes to the self. What goes? Is that ahankara, that I notion that has been identified here, now shifts over. That's the going. It shifts over to what? It recognizes that my being is the bhuta yoni, is the very womb, the very one from whom this whole thing comes. It's the whole thing. The conscious being that I am is the conscious being from which the entire creation comes. And so in this verse it says, that yoni realizes saha brahma, that he is Brahma, he is Shiva, he is Vishnu. See that Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu? Actually goes Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. We look at Ishwara. The name Ishwara is the name for the Lord. These three aspects, Brahmaji, Vishnu, and Shiva. We look at Ishwara, means the whole projection of the meadow, the projection of the whole infinite creation. That act of coming into manifestation, of Ishwara coming into the manifestation, like the manifestation of infinite knowledge, we call that aspect of Ishwara Brahma. So now here it says, Saha Brahma, Brahmaji, not Brahman, Brahmaji. It's in the masculine. So Brahmaji is Ishwara manifesting as this infinite creation. Vishnu is, now the creation is manifest, it stays for a while. So the sustainer. So for you, say if you're the Ishwara of the meadow, you're the Ishwara of the meadow, that act of manifesting the meadow, bringing your meadow knowledge that is in unmanifest condition into manifest condition. So the meadow knowledge, which is unmanifest, becomes manifest. And everything in it, right? The meadow can be very complex with many, many things in the meadow. That so that your knowledge of meadow now manifests as meadow. That's Brahma. That's Ishwara in the aspect of Brahma, the creator. Mm-hmm. Now that this meadow has come, you sustain the meadow. Ishwara sustains the meadow. It just doesn't go away right away. It is sustained. That's Vishnu. The ability for the creation, that knowledge itself to hold in position, right? For some time. That's Vishnu. And Shiva is the resolution of the meadow, right? So here, that's for you as Ishwara. You're Ishwara of your meadow, okay? But for Ishwara, it's the same me, the exact same conscious meaning. You have to do an identity shift, because when you think me now, you think me in terms of your body, mind, sense organs, this what we call this body-mind complex. You know, the body, the mind, the sense organs, all your relations, all of your thoughts in your mind, all your moods, all your emotions, the whole thing. That's what you mean when you say me. But if we do the identity shift and you recognize that this body, mind, sense organs, everything about it, all of its qualities really belong to Ishwara. Like the individual in the meadow belongs to the meadow. It belongs, it's part and parcel of the meadow. It belongs to Ishwara. It belongs to the whole manifestation. This body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishwara, and the I, which this mind has attached, this mind has, that says I am, right? It's not Brahman, yourself, consciousness isn't saying I am. Your mind is saying I am. The mind that says I am is saying not I am the infinite consciousness from which the whole meadow has come. It's saying, I am this person here. That's what it says. But the reality is that I am the consciousness which I am, the me that I am, is the one from whom the meadow has come. I am the meadow, in fact. I'm the whole. It's exactly that same here. Now we are the ones walking within the creation. Instead of your little character walking in the meadow, here we are. We are in the creation. We are part and parcel of this creation, and our mind says, I am, correctly labeling. When you say me, you say I am, you are correctly labeling yourself, but then you're adding on the body, mind, sense organs. Instead of saying, if you say like this, I am, so far so good, right? You're perfect. That is perfect. No, not anything wrong. So the I am, you're correctly labeling your sense of me. Now the thing is you just have to recognize that your me, the me that you are, is in fact the me of the whole creation. It's the me from which the entire creation comes, including this body, mind, sense organs, and your body, mind, sensors, and yours, and yours, and yours, and yours, and the hummingbird, and Tibby, and all beings. All beings. Without exception. All the good ones and all the bad ones. All the dark ones and all of the light ones. All the positive ones. All the negative ones. All beings. You know, like imagine your meadow, and now I say, okay, just put a few monsters in the meadow. Okay? Are you sure you can have monsters in the meadow? You know how to, you have monsters inside that you can imagine. Put some monsters in the meadow. Put some heroes in the meadow. You know? Put some friendly animals in the meadow and put some, you know, vicious animals in the meadow. Put good weather in the meadow, put bad weather in the meadow. All of those things, right? They're all of dualities, all of what we call the dwandhas that can exist in the meadow are not away from me. It's not like the monster is less me, right, than the hero. They're both manifest. They're both. You have to say like this. Both of them have me for their being, and I am free of both of them. The meadow has me for its being. I am free of the meadow. You have me for your being, right? And I am free of you. It's really beautiful when you think of it. That was kind of being facetious there, but actually the reality is that I am you. It's not that I'm like you. There's only one I. There's only one I, and the entire meadow enjoys it. There's only one I, and the entire creation enjoys it. And who is that I? That I is me. So people will say, and this people say, I don't want to lose the personal me. But the personal me is you. The personal me is the me of the entire creation. That is the personal me. There's no impersonal me. There's only me. So you have to say that, oh, that I don't want to become an impersonal me. You would have to say right now the me that you are is impersonal. See what I mean? It's not this body, mind, sense organ that makes me personal or impersonal. Because you are correct right now when you say I am, the I am that you're referring to is your sense of self that if in fact the whole creation were to drop, you still are. You know, just like if I withdraw the meadow or I project the meadow, I still am. It has nothing to do with my being at all. And my being is me. It is the most personal thing. It's the most dear thing. There's no possibility of it ever being impersonal. But we tend to think that for it to be personal, it has to just belong to me, this body, because I've taken me to be this body. You see, the superimposition is so profound. I take me to be this body, and so any me that's other than this body is really not me. Because the superimposition is so much. But what I'm saying is that the me that is you, that you take to be you right now, if this body drops dead at this moment, nothing happens to you. The you that you take to be you right now. And that you is Brahman. That is the you of the meadow. That is the you, that is the me of the entire creation. So here, that's what he's saying. The self with the Muni, with the one who's meditating, has meditated in terms of this Kaivalya Upanishad, that Muni, the one who has realized this, he knows, you know, I am Shiva. I am Vishnu. I am Brahmaji. I am Vishnu. I am Shiva. I am Prana. The prana is the very life force that all beings enjoy. I'm the prana. I am kala. I am time itself. Because time exists within me. I watch the ticking of time. I am time because, you know when we say time, the movement of time through past, present, and future? There's the past, present, and future, as we'll see in the next verse. The past, when it occurs, is the present. Right? Of course, the present, when it occurs, is the present, and the future, when it occurs, is the present. And so, in fact, I am the presence which is there, present to the past, present to the present, and present to the future. So I am the very presence, right? I am the presence of the present. And in fact, the idea of a past and future, I can say, like, let's have an idea of the past. Just remember your drive over, your transportation getting over here. That's past. It's already gone. But you can't, when you remember that, your recollection of that past event is taking place in the present. When the past event was actually taking place, it was present. And now your recollection of it is also taking place in the present. In fact, it's impossible for us ever to get out of the present because our memories of the past are in the present. And when the past was occurring, it was the present. And our projections into the future are projections that are taking place in the present. Our future projections are taking place in the present. And when the future comes, that also will be the present. So in fact, from our standpoint, there is no time. I am the presence of time. And we can never move out of that presence in any way. So I am the very being, the very presence, the very self of time. And then he says, I am the fire, I am the Agnihi, I am the fire, I am the sun, I am the moon, just going through all of these things. I'm all of the luminaries. Chandramaha means the moon. You can also say, I'm the Suryaha, I'm the sun, I'm the Agni, I'm all of the luminaries. I'm everything that I see. I'm the table, I'm the rug, I'm the space, I'm the clothes, I'm the chair. There's nothing that I am because I'm nothing here that I'm not, because I'm the very being which the whole thing enjoys. Remember, in terms of the meadow, the whole meadow, this, because of your maya, the consciousness has maya. It has this capacity, you know, to imagine, to project. That's the maya is. That maya is extraordinary. That's why sometimes we translate it just in day-to-day parlance. We translate maya as magic. You have, as Brahman, the conscious being that you are, you have maya. There's still advaita. You're still absolutely non-dual, even with this maya, because maya, this ability to project a creation, you know, like you can project a meadow, you can project the whole Adishwara, the whole manifest creation. That capacity that you have in no way touches you, changes you, or is away from you. Right? If maya had a being, a separate existence, a separate being, a separate content other than you, then we'd say there's dvaita, there's myself, the conscious being, and there's this maya, you know, which has a reality separate from me. But maya has no reality separate from me. That's why you can say, I can ask you to imagine a meadow. You have this incredible capacity that allows for the imagination of a meadow. And then I can say, okay, is there you in the meadow? There's you, and you with this manifestation of the meadow, but does the manifestation of the meadow have any being apart from you? You would say no. The meadow comes from you, is sustained by you, and resolves into you. The meadow doesn't have any being of its own, right, at all. That's the advaita. If there were two beings, right, if there were two beings, it would be dvaita, it would be dual. But there's you with this capacity that has no separate being apart from you. Let me give another example. If we use clay pot and rope snake, so let's look at clay pot. If I have a clay pot, right? There's only clay there. There's nothing there but clay. But there's a pot, right? There's clay, there's a clay pot. But then I ask you, is there clay and the pot? Is there clay here and the pot? Like, can you take the pot away from the clay so that we have dvaita, so that we have two? There's a clay and a pot. No. There's not clay in a pot. There's only clay. But there's a pot. Right? But the pot has no being apart from the clay. So that is advaita. Even though the pot is useful. Right? The pot is useful. But it has no, it can't be separated from the clay. Another example we use, just to really give you that, that just shows how the names and forms that we experience have no independent being from their own substance. But if we look at something like the Maya of the rope snake, that's a beautiful example of Maya. If a rope appears as a snake, right, there's nothing there but the rope. The bends of the snake, right? The diameter of the snake, the length of the snake, the fangs of the snake are only the rope. And the snake doesn't extend beyond the rope. If the rope is 2 inches in diameter, the snake is 2 inches in diameter, not 2.5 inches. If the three bends, the snake only has three bends, not four bends. If the snake has fangs, it's because there's some of the twine sticking out of the rope. Otherwise, there's no fangs. Okay? So really, there's the rope, the snake, which doesn't look like the rope. Okay, it looks like a snake. It doesn't look like a rope. But itself, its being, is only the rope. If I remove the rope, I remove the snake. Okay? So now with this one, from the standpoint, look at how this goes. The snake has no being without the rope. It totally depends on the rope for its being. Right? If I remove the rope, the snake is gone. But from the standpoint of the rope, there's no dependence on the snake whatsoever. Right? And from the standpoint of the rope, there's only rope. There isn't even a snake there. Right? It's the same for the clay. It's a little different example, has a little different intent. But look at the situation of the clay. The pot can say, I'm a clay pot, but the clay will just say, I'm clay. What do you mean, pot? I'm clay. And so here, this is our situation here that has to be recognized, where I see this is only me. I'm the rope here. I'm the changeless rope. Right? And that they're just like the snake, in no way, in no part of the snake is in any way away from me. Nothing in my experience, nothing in this creation is in any way separate from me. I'm its very being. And at the same time, nothing ever happens to me. That's why I love using your imagination. Whether you imagine a meadow, or you have your choice of whatever infinite number of imaginations you can concoct. It makes no difference at all. Whatever the imagination is, you are the changeless self of the imagination, and you can experience. It's an uparoksha jnana. It's a direct, immediate recognition that in terms of your imagination, that even while the imagination is there, you're not being touched by it in any way. Your being is pervasive. It is clean. It is pure. Nothing can touch it. I like the example of if you imagine the meadow and you imagine it starting to pour, It's pouring in the meadow. Everything in the meadow is getting drenched. But nothing happens to you. You can have the winds come, blowing all of the trees in the meadow. And for the characters in the meadow, their hair is all flying all over them, their clothes are blowing. Your being, which is the very self of the meadow, is completely untouched. Right? The birds are chirping. You're breathing. You, the character, you're breathing. The birds are chirping. Yourself is still. So right now you can recognize, we have such a strong Dehatma Buddhi. Dehatma Buddhi means that notion of the Atma. Buddhi is here's the notion of the self being the Deha, the body. It's so strong. Right, that it's hard for you initially. That's why Nididhyasana and different types of meditation are so important, because it helps you recognize, you know, the profound stability, strength, silent presence of your being, the me. You know, the very personal me, the changeless, strong, untouched being that you are. The meditation helps for you to differentiate that. But in the end, what you see is, this is you. This is not away from you. It is you. It depends on you for its being, but you are totally untouched by it. That's the asanga. I am asanga. Asanga means I'm unattached. I'm untouched by all of this. Yeah? So when Swamiji says, your heart has to be as big as Ishwara. He's talking about a Jivan Mukta, somebody who is liberated. And means their mind is mature in this knowledge. They have Nishta in this knowledge. Your heart is as big as Ishwara because of Vairagya. Because you don't have this superimposition, which takes some time for all of that to unwind. You know, you don't have this superimposition of my being an object within the creation. Like when you, as Ishwara of the meadow, as the Lord of the meadow, you are Ishwara. You don't, you're Jnananishta. You are rooted in your knowledge. You're, as you're imagining the meadow and the people are walking through it, as the Ishwara of the meadow, you're not all of a sudden becoming the person in the meadow. Everything in the meadow is, and everything in the meadow is me, and I am free of it. That's my experience. I have Nishta in terms of the meadow. My heart is as big as Ishwara. I am Ishwara, in fact, in that. Here, right? See, I can say I don't have to say in terms of the meadow that my heart is as big as Ishwara, because I am Ishwara, right? In reference to the meadow. But the one in the meadow who now has to meet his meadow teacher, his guru, right? For that one's heart has to become as big as Ishwara. Because that one, in order to have this Jnananishta, really, the one in the meadow can't get all lost in the meadow saying, oh, I need this to be that way, and this to be that way, and this person to be that way, and this person to be that way, in order for me to be happy. That person's lost in the meadow. They're lost in the samsara of the meadow. Whereas the jnani is the one who can appreciate their position in the meadow, right? Follow dharma in the meadow, and appreciate the meadow as Ishwara, and take what comes. Because of your power, there's still a lot involved in that, so I won't get into all of that detail now. So here he says, he recognizes he is Brahman, he is Shiva, he is Indra. Indra is the Lord of all of the heavens. See, all of these, there's many different lokas, many different planes of existence, and in the heaven worlds, in the Hindu cosmology, the Indra is the name for the Lord of these different regions, heavenly regions. So he is Indra. He is Indra. He is Aksharaha. Aksharaha means the one who is, Akshara means the one who is immutable. So he's going from Indra to Aksharaha, the one that doesn't perish. He is Paramaha. He is the Supreme. So Aksharaha and Paramaha means Brahman, the Self. I am the Self. I am the changeless being. I am Paramaha, the Supreme. I am Aksharaha, free from any decline. I am Shiva. I am Vishnu. I am Brahmaji. And I am Swarat. I am self-luminous. I am the one who shines of my own accord. So here, go back to yourself in the meadow. Nothing is lighting you up. The conscious me, the one from whom the meadow imagination comes, who lights me up? I am the light. Consciousness itself is the light because of which the whole meadow is recognized. Consciousness itself is the one. Say if I were to turn out all of these lights and it was pitch black in here. Pitch black. I am the light that illumines the blackness. Consciousness is the luminary that illumines all experience, whether it be pitch black or light out or whatever, or it's an imagination, whatever it is, whatever the perception is, whatever the feeling is, whatever the emotion is, consciousness is the one because of whom that is lit up, that is known. That's Swarat. I am my own luminary because I am the consciousness because of which everything is known. I am the one that illumines the light and illumines the darkness. Right? That's an interesting recognition, is that if you turn out all the lights and it's pitch black, then what? Then you're aware of the pitch black. You're the one that lights up the pitch black. Okay? Consciousness lights up without, it lights up itself without any subject-object relationship. It is the luminary itself. And everything else is lit up because of it. And then it says, I'm the Chandrama. I'm the moon. So it goes through with all of this, and then it goes, let's chant this next one.
Sa eva sarvam yad bhutam yacchabhavyam sanatanam yacchnyatvatam mrityum asyeti nanyapantabhimuktiye.
He says, he recognizes, this Muni recognizes that he, the self, remember the identity shift. The identity shift has taken place. I recognize now that myself, the I, has now moved to my own being. That I, in fact, am everything. I am all of this. I am the whole meadow. I am the whole creation. Right? I am everything. Yad Bhutam. Not just everything that is here now, yad bhutam, that which has come before, yet chabhavyam, and that will come, that which will come in the future, that which has been, and that which will come into the future. Sanatanam, I in fact am free of time. I am all of this, that which has been, that which is, that which will be. In fact, I am sanatanam, I always am. I am free of time. Nyatvatam, having known this, having recognized this, having known this, Nyatvatam, having known that, Mrityum Atyeti, he crosses death. Atyeti means he goes beyond, he crosses Mrityum. Mrityum means death. Because see, if we go back to the meadow example, you can have your I thought identified with the character in the meadow, or with you. If you identified, if you think your being belongs to the character in the meadow, say you've entered the meadow, your character in the meadow, your I thought, your sense of self, is attached to the body, mind, sense organs of the character in the meadow, you have definitely haven't crossed death. Because for you, you think your body, mind, sense organs is you, then you think you're going to die. In fact, you'll be very surprised because that's not going to happen. Even if you think it is, say if you say you're just a total atheist and a what we call a charvaka, what you know for certain, you know for certain that you are this. And that's it. When you die, when this body dies, you will die. It's over. I'm absolutely certain. Don't tell me. Don't tell me anything different. And if I, on my deathbed, Christopher Hitchens, who has cancer now, he says, because he doesn't, you know, he has serious cancer, so he probably won't live very long. He's just a renowned atheist. So he says, he was being interviewed, and the interviewer, I forget who it was, asked him, did you see that? Maybe it was Charlie Rose or somebody. He said, you know, do you feel yourself changing, or do you think that you might change your mind now that you're, you know, on your deathbed? And he said, absolutely not. He goes, absolutely not. And if I do, it's because I've gone off. I've gone off. This is no longer me talking. Because I've become delusional or something. So if I should say anything like that, don't believe it. I absolutely don't think that. You know?
Right. Conviction.
Yeah. And so what the Upanishads would say, and which I will personally vouch for, I'll tell you that why in a minute, that I will personally vouch for, is that he's going to be really surprised. He's going to go, oh my God. Because nothing will happen. Nothing to yourself. Just like when you wake up from a dream, the whole dream is gone. There isn't the slightest flicker of change. Because asanga, consciousness, your being doesn't change at all. Of course, the environment will change. But that isn't even shocking. Like when you wake up from the dream, sometimes you'll be disappointed that it ended early or something like that. But it's not a shock to you because it's just the way things are. It's the way things always have been. You know, and so even for, say, a samsari, when your body drops, do you know that your body, you have lost your body countless number of times, actually beginningless number of times? How many bodies have you lost? Billions and billions, countless, infinite number of bodies you've lost. And so it's not that you're inexperienced. It's just a new thing. It's not a new thing. But when you take this physical body, there's no memory of the other states. And so you're trapped in that type of fear, and the identification with the physical body is so much, you know. But in reality, when you lose this body, nothing happens at all. And that what my memory, I'll just share quickly with you. When I was in India, my first trip there, I'd been with Swamiji for just a few months really, but I got cholera, and just kind of a surprise attack. coming down from Rishikesh to Madras, and I must have picked it up when I was in Rishikesh. By the time I got to Madras, I was really almost dead. And then they had a wheelchair and whatnot waiting for me somehow. I don't know how that all happened, but waiting for me when the train pulled in, and they took me to where Swamiji was. But all that while, I was totally dying, and my sense organs were going in and out, and I was just losing total touch with this world. It never ever occurred to me that I was dying. I thought it never crossed my mind, because there is no such experience. I mean, all of this change was taking place, my sense organs coming and going and all this kind of stuff. And so weak, I couldn't move, and I was just totally physically a mess. But it never occurred to me that I was dying or anything, because there's not the slightest change that happens to you, to the you that you take yourself to be. There's not the slightest change. That's why I say, when you say right now, when you say I am, meaning me, you're talking about yourself, that is perfect. The one that you're labeling is you. It's just that you've added on all this other stuff, and this other stuff that you've added on is going to die. It's finite, and it will go. But you won't. There'll never be the slightest flicker. And so then, to just finish the story off, by the time they got me to the clinic where they were taking me, I had kind of, you know, died for a few moments, no pulse, that type of thing.
Jesus.
And I did totally leave my body completely. I had this kind of thought. All there was, it was just me, and there's this thought walked through, this is what Swamiji meant. You know, but as I had that little thought, and then they had given me glucose or something, and I just swooshed back into the body. Very interesting. And then when Swamiji came to visit a few hours later to see how I was doing, you know, I told him what happened, and he says, that'll help. He said, that's good, that'll help. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Good experience to have something like that. It was funny. But so here, this for the jnani, this identity shift has taken place from you've given up this superimposition of what is not you on you. And that is the you going beyond death. The going beyond death is recognizing that death is not something that belongs to you. It's not your nature. It doesn't happen. There's no past, present, and future. There's just you, your being. And this whole creation comes from you, is sustained by you, and goes back into you. So he says, so having realized this, he crosses death. And then it says, there is na anyaha panta vimuktiye. There is no other path to liberation. There is no other path to liberation than this. And then everybody goes, oh, how can you say that? Are you saying that this is the only way? Yeah. But you have to understand what we mean. You have to understand what is meant there. Your being already is liberated. There is no path, in fact. What path? The path is knowledge. Now, that knowledge can take place in many different languages, in many different cultures, in many different ways. There can be so many teaching methodologies, but what's a teaching methodology? What does it have to do? It has to reveal yourself to you. You know, you have to recognize yourself. That is the liberation. It's the liberating the liberated. How do you liberate the liberated? By removing the ignorance. Is there another way to do it? What other way is there to liberate the liberated other than removing the ignorance?
Mm.
So we can say there are many countless ways to becoming saintly, to gaining purity of mind. You know, so many gain stillness of mind, all different meditative techniques and different types of pranayama, different types of yoga, different types of karma yoga, different types of behavior, dharmic behavior that leads to antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind. You know, there are so many different ways of going about that. You know, it's countless. And it can be just designed towards you and your personality type and whatnot, what your different sadhanas that you need in order to bring the mind into a relative shanti. That is countless. And that shanti, that level of relative peace is necessary for your mind to be able to be in a position to gain knowledge, because if your mind doesn't have any peace or any stability, how can the teacher shove that knowledge in there? your mind has to be available, right? It needs a certain amount of peace. And so there's many ways to develop that type of good health, physical, emotional, and mental peace. But in the end, you have to know. You have to know who you are. You either are the whole or you're not. If you're not, you're bound. Just by nature, what are you going to do about that? You can do all kinds of things to make your bound self be as healthy as possible, have as much shanti as possible, you know, to be in as best shape as possible. You can do all kinds of things for that. But now your bound self, yourself that is subject to birth and death and disease and old age, right, is just being handled as in the best way that you possibly can. And so you're a healthy, bound person. But you're not a liberated one. You either are the whole or you're not. And if you are the whole, there's nothing you can do about that except to know it. You have to cross over, you know, from being identified with Maya, what is not you intrinsically, to what is you, so that you can recognize, you know, I'm the meadow, I'm the whole meadow, and I'm not just that. It's not enough that I'm the whole meadow and I'm free of the meadow. Right? But the thing is, the one in the meadow is the one that has to realize it, so it's harder. Okay? We can use this example and have the thrill of being Ishwara in terms of the meadow. Ishwara has it easy because no ajnanam, there's no ignorance there. But it's the one in the meadow that has to recognize it. So that takes a lot of understanding. A lot of, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? The mind has to firmly see it. For here, you, this person in this creation, has to recognize I am the whole. So there's a lot to understand there, you know. And it's the mind that has to understand it, because the mind is the one that takes itself to be this. Because you have a mind, there's a problem. The table doesn't have a problem. You know, the chair doesn't have a problem. You have a problem because you have a mind. You have a mind that reflects consciousness and so avails itself to that mistake. Once the mind says, I am this body, mind, sense organs, then you have to take on all the qualities of this body, mind, sense organs in terms of being healthy or sick or, you know, pretty or homely or, I mean, it's just endless, popular or not popular, yeah. You know, being subject to birth and death and all of the travails of being immortal. Mm. That's just how it is.
And there's so many.
Yeah. And those things are all fine if I'm free. Then I can just live this out, appreciating all of this as Ishwara and seeing what my place is in Ishwara. Watch Ishwara's life world unfold and be involved in it. I can be totally involved in it because I'm totally free in it. Mm-hmm. So, okay, let's stop there.
Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishthe Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Namaha Hari Om.
When you said to yourself that Swamiji was, you recognized that Swamiji was right.
Yeah.
Is it still mind or how?
It was just a thought. I can't really explain it. Why that thought came, it wasn't that I was thinking it. That was just a thought that presented itself.
Oh.
And it was also kind of strange because there was just me there. There was just conscious, my being was there. And then this kind of ephemeral thought came, but it all happened very quickly. Then I re-entered.
But there was a sense of well-being, or you didn't...
Yeah, there was nothing strange.
Nothing strange.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it was a totally different thing, but I think that that totally different experience, first of all, yourself is you. So there's no change there. And that embodied experience was... I mean, I don't know what that... It wasn't strange, but it was very fast. Because by that time, they'd got the glucose and... So who knows how long that was. I don't know what part to say.
No, that's not the important part.
Yeah.
Well, like in the state of like deep sleep or whatever, where, you know, we sort of, I mean, when you look back on it, it feels like you weren't there in some sense because there's no memory of it. But I think when you really look at it, there's, you know, you are aware of it, but...
You are, there is a memory of it in the sense
right.
you can describe it.
Right, you can say stuff well. You know, or there.
Yeah.
So, and I know I've had an experience in a couple of times where there's a... somehow a stronger sense of presence in that, where I'm seemingly more aware that there's nothing happening. But just trying to, like, you know, that sort of our experience of time, I think, relates so much to the amount of memories that are packed into, you know, a certain amount of time. So it's like experience of deep sleep, we don't tend to experience time really because there's no memory to put it together afterwards.
Yeah, and there's no thought flow, right?
Right.
And so, because the mind's in a resolved condition.
Right.
That's what we say, in fact, it goes into its kind of unmanifest condition. So, in real deep sleep, when you're not dreaming, it's not a liminal state, there's no time at all.
Right.
Right.
So, but, you know, I'm sort of, you know, just trying to project that into a, you know, an after-death state or somehow, you know, contrast to the experience. Because it's like... You know, all of the thoughts and emotions and sensations that we have in various states of mind and body, you know, if we assume those are of the body, and that when the body drops, those levels won't be witnessed as such.
Well, actually, what they say is what actually transmigrates. You know, so we're just talking
right.
about any person, a jiva.
Sure.
What transmigrates are the subtle body, which is made up of the mind, and the subtle sense organs. The mind, the subtle sense organs.
Okay.
And the mind has four types. It's got the eye thought, the intellect, the fluctuating mind, and the chitta, the memory.
The memory.
That transmigrates.
It does.
It does.
Yeah.
And then the sense organs transmigrate. The sense organs that take a physical body.
Right.
So the subtle sense organs,
right.
and then the subtle prana. The vital force, and that's what allows that enlivens the body, that transmigrates. So there's like 19 components that transmigrate. So the thing is, when you leave this body, you could part of your travels, you could have sleep.
Sure, I see.
But part of it, most of it, you'll be awake. You could go into an unmanifest condition like a deep sleep, but only be temporary.
I see. Interesting.
And then you'd be traveling in different locus depending upon your karma.
So I've been reading about, you know, all this sort of, you know, modern research about consciousness and looking at something called the neural correlates of consciousness and trying to sort of put those ideas together in that, like, we can look at the parts of the brain that, you know, light up, so to speak, when you have this kind of experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously you can't reduce it to that. There's no way. I mean, consciousness and a lot of the subtle layers are just clearly beyond the body, but it's interesting to me to really, you know.
But they'll use the body.
Right, that's it. You know,
yeah,
it's
completely.
Like, the only thing I can really kind of liken it to in my own imagination is like a hard drive, but the subtle body is the data, so to speak. You know.
Yeah, kind of like that, exactly. And the brain and the body is very sophisticated, so that the subtle body, you know, pervades it completely.
Right, I see.
And so, and then when the subtle body leaves, then that instrument can't function anymore.
Right.
What is the fluctuating mind exactly?
The manas.
Oh, that's the manas.
The manas, yeah.
I see. So it's the
deliberative mind, the one that has, it's not, it's taking in data, but it's not making any kind of a decision. Also, the emotions are there with the manas, the darker emotions. Mm-hmm. The positive emotions are in the anandamaya kosha, when the mind is actually become subtle.
Oh, so the subtle
moody type of emotions are in the manas.
The subtle body doesn't have anything to do with the gross, the mind and the
When the subtle body that has the mind and the sense organ, the subtle mind, the sense organs and the organs of action, all of that, the prana, that will totally inhabit a physical body.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it'll take on a physical body, but when this physical body drops and those karmas are over, that mind will then, it'll keep, the subtle body will keep taking a form that's true to whatever field of experience it's in. It'll always take a form.
So how does the chitta then work with that situation, in that we don't remember our past lives, and that, you know, just for instance, to someone who has a head injury or whatever, yeah, and loses their memory, you know, well, that whatever amount of memory seems to be, you know, related to the brain or whatever.
When you take a physical body when you're first born, mm-hmm, for most children, you're not bringing in much memory with you, even though you have a infinite storehouse of karmas.
Right.
Right.
Uh-huh.
But that's not being experienced when you take the physical body.
Yeah.
Except for some children, they will have memory till like they're 3 or 4 years old. They're detailed memory of,
sure,
past lives.
Sure.
So this physical body really isn't meant for that. It would be very confusing.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
And so when the jiva comes into this body, the brain itself is a fresh brain.
Right.
You know, and it's just like if you dream, for instance, they say, you have 10 seconds max to imprint a dream onto your brain.
Hmm.
Which means you yourself, you have to recall it.
Right.
To get that imprint, otherwise it'll go and you can't get it back.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So here what they say, I don't have a lot of these details, so they're out there to be had in the tradition.
Yeah.
When you are between bodies, taking a physical birth, you have a much longer span. You do remember your life. You don't see your life as just this one little life.
Mm.
This one life is just a small piece of a whole long thread.
Mm.
Right? And you have much more access to the entirety of the thread of your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a whole different time zone and everything.
Sure.
Right? So you do, the chitta is available to you in a much bigger way,
mm-hmm,
than when you're just embodied, and that's what they say.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And there's a lot more details that I haven't studied. I'm not that interested, but
right.
I mean, I'm somewhat interested.
No, I hear you. I mean, it's something to ponder because of the, you know, I mean, you know, just because there is such a tendency in common thinking to associate ourselves with the body. You know,
absolutely.
So if we get hit in the head, we lose our memory, you know, like, what is, how does that, there's,
or what if you lose your eyesight and you're blind when you leave this body?
Right.
You know, then your subtle sense organs are fine.
Right.
But this physical body is damaged, or the physical brain is damaged.
Right, right.
You know, so it's not operable. There's nothing wrong with this, your mind,
right,
on a subtle level, but it can't function in this broken,
right,
Upadhi,
well, there's
you know,
like two jivas here then, or the...
No, this is just an instrument. The subtle body is using this instrument. But say the instrument breaks down, then the subtle body is there, but it can't use the instrument. Or say you use a jiva, transmigrating jiva, you take an animal body. Then all of the capacities of the jiva are, you know, some will be heightened actually, like for instance, for say a cat or a cat, their sense of hearing, you know, and smell is so profoundly greater than ours. But then in other capacities, they don't have the same capacity. So the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, will be limited by the form that you take based upon your karmas. Because of your karma, you get to be a cat for a while or whatever. You know, or a dog, or, you know. See what I mean, though?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been using the, I mean, the computer analogy sort of is the only way I can wrap my head around it.
Yeah, what if the hardware breaks down?
Right.
Software is fine.
Right, or the data itself.
It's fine, yeah.
You
just have to plug it into another computer.
Right, right. Or it has to be, I mean, in some sense it exists just as information. You know, I mean, it's saying that, you know, it could get wiped off of a hard drive, but it's like, but the information, yeah, anyway. You can sort of play with that for a while.
Oh yeah, go ahead. Did you want to ask something? Is there, I have a question. What if it's the core of the resistance of the one in the meadow to recognize that he, she is actually the meadow? I mean, what's at the core of that resistance? Because there seems to be some kind of...
It's like a vairagya. You know, because... I mean, who's going to want to know they're the meadow?
Who doesn't want to know, actually.
The question won't arise. The question need not even arise, because the who am I question is taken care of so completely by your surroundings. You know, like I am a, you know, you are, I am this person, you know, this is my friend, this is my child. This is what I'm doing today. This is where I came from. These are my parents. So the I question is always being answered continually.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But then somebody can say, well, wait a minute. Who am I really? Who's the person that's playing all of these roles? Is there anything about me that survives that? That type of self-reflection, that need not happen. You know, that self-reflection is considered great punya. They say, you know, after lifetimes and lifetimes of dharma, a person has enough introspection to pull them, to give them a little distance from their situation and make them analyze the situation and become self-reflective, like, what is really going on here? Who am I really? You know, that's a huge thing. Like, I always joke about my mom when I came back from India, and I kind of was trying to explain to her what it was like, and very shortly into the conversation she said, oh honey, I don't have those kind of problems.
That stopped you.
It's not exactly a problem.
but
it wasn't interested, you know.
So what you're saying makes sense, right? And then there's also a level that there, why I call it specifically resistance, as kind of like a core resistance. You know, there's, as if there's some kind of wiring that's just not in place to facilitate the moment-to-moment recognition of what you laid out so beautifully as you are the meadow. I mean, you spoke at it from 20 different directions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just tonight, right? And so when I listen to it, it's like, yeah, this makes total sense. You know, I recognize this is the truth. But it's not like at every given moment I can hold that in my own consciousness. And I know we talked about that too. There's a certain kind of molding that takes place. There's some time factor.
That
the whole system needs to adapt to that consciousness. But I'm just still wondering, is it really, but that seems like a resistance in the system or something, as if the wires are not strong enough to just instantly hold that consciousness
it can't instantly do it, because it's like saying instant vairagya. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden somebody gives me this knowledge and everything I've always felt, everything I've always wanted, I thought, I need this to be happy, I need that to be happy, you know, just poof, disappears. That isn't true. That all of those desires, all of those needs, all of those childhood wounds and hurts, all of those things have to present themselves in the light of this knowledge. And that, you know, it just takes some time. And in the end, you know, you enjoy your life here. It's not like you run away from your life, but your life doesn't cover the truth of your being. You know, so you can live your life and you have this body, mind, sense organs, you get to walk through your true Ishwar, really. But you can only do that to the degree that there's been a shift, what I didn't talk about tonight, but there's also a shift that from the projection of Ananda onto the world to the recognition of the source of the Ananda that I've projected onto the world as being the nature of the Atman. In the nature of the self. That's what solves the whole thing. Right? Is once I understand, you know, I need this to be happy, I need that to be happy. You need to be happy. That's right. But the source of the happiness that you're seeking is yourself. And so when the nature of Ananda is the brahman swarupa, the very nature of the self. And so once the mind recognizes that, it no longer asks the creation to do it, because that Ananda is basking in that Ananda. Mm-hmm. When the mind is basking in the Ananda which it used to seek from the world, mm-hmm. now it's basking in it, then you can afford to let the world be as it is. Mm-hmm. If you yourself aren't full and complete, then you're still looking for it, you know?
Yeah, I'm out there.
Yeah, you're looking for it. Right. But what about when you are full and complete because your mind has come home? Right. And that isn't instantaneous either, because the desires are, and the illusion is so much.
And they come in funny ways, different ways.
Yeah, but more, what you find is as you develop clarity, your mind stays home more and more and more, and it doesn't like to go out. It's not worth it. I'd rather just, you know, do what is to be done in this situation, you know, to play my part in the situation and to be as helpful as possible. All of that is fine. That's Dharma. That's nice. But I don't want to get into a situation where I feel like if this doesn't work out this way, I won't be happy. You know, where I'm superimposing my well-being on the situation. You can see it, your mind can have a tendency, like my mind wants to do that. I'll just say, no, I don't think so. Just a little moment of self-reflection is necessary. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I don't want to enjoy the situation, mm-hmm. or that, you know, or participate in it. I just don't want to be in a needy mm-hmm. relationship with it. Right. Because there's not fun.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's not an enjoyable situation, and it's not necessary. It's just that we're so programmed to,
yeah.
you know, and the programming is so subtle. I mean, it just pervades into everything. It takes a while to mature, and you can enjoy the maturing process. We're all maturing. I mean, I enjoy that process.
Yeah.
Every moment, every little step of maturation that you take makes life better than it was before. That's just how it is. Yeah.
But it's also like every moment of suffering is a reflection of the disconnect.
Every moment of suffering is your sadhana.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that moment of suffering forces the issue. Because then if you have knowledge, mm-hmm. then that moment of suffering is okay. What is it? Mm-hmm. And then how to be with that in a way that resolves it, to understand it. And it's important to know how to do that too, especially when there are complexes and mm-hmm. things like that. We have to know how to be with those things in a way that allows them to mature mm-hmm. and to heal. You have to be a really, really good friend to your mind. Mm. You have to love it and care for it and raise it like you would raise a child. Mm. With, you know, your own child, how much you love and care for your child, and that you just want to help your little child. That's what you want to do. You want to help and to nourish your child and make that child, you know, grow up and to be happy and all of that. So you have to have that type of love for your own mind and for your own complexes, where you want to help.
Yeah.
with
really
care.
That amount of attention then.
That amount of care. Yeah, that's right.
Really? Because you're not taught that, you know?
I mean, no, you're not taught that.
Uh-uh.
But anything less than that is not enough. And in fact, that type of attitude is what you end up having toward the whole world. Mm. But if you don't turn that toward your complexes and the different parts inside, then they're left out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have all this vairagya and then...
Right. So that's her over here.
Yeah. Except for me.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of what you see in the tradition sometimes, you know, because, as you said, it takes so many parts of development, you know, so somebody can have a great Vedanta understanding, but they maybe haven't done their psycho-emotional homework, you know.
Well, we'd say, like, there's emotional lag time for everybody. you understand much more than, your buddhi, your knowledge... you know, the knowledge, I mean, real knowledge, not just, I mean, real knowing, you know, will take place way before your emotions catch up with it.
Well, that's the point of everybody, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just about, unless you've done all this emotional work before.
Because you can feel like you're failing at Vedanta because of this lifetime, isn't it?
Yeah, but if you feel like that, that means that there's a missing of understanding that would cause you to feel that way. That understanding has to penetrate into that so that you understand what's going on with your poor little mind.
Can you say more about that? Because that's kind of interesting. Well, it's just a general statement, but I mean, what's the implications of that, you know, that your emotional body is just kind of catching up more.
Yeah, because the buddhi gains knowledge, and the buddhi is the one, in fact, that is the commentator of the emotional mind.
Right.
And the emotions are all stored in the unconscious.
Right.
There's all kinds of unconscious baggage there, childhood things. And so your knowledge has to be with those parts in a way to let them mature. And also your vairagya grows in the light of your knowledge. So as you gain knowledge, your vairagya, your dispassion, you know. Dispassion means like a, you know, the helium balloon example, that you can love having the balloon, and once it goes its way, that's fine too. That's vairagya. So with your knowledge, that will grow. And as it grows, you gain more nishtha. Mm-hmm. And as you gain more nishtha, the vairagya grows like that. Mm-hmm. But so that's vairagya. But then there's also addressing... Do you have a little look on your shirt? What is that?
There's a little tag.
Oh, it's just a tag.
Yeah.
It's a tag?
Yeah. Oh, it's an advertisement.
You know what it looks like? It looks like a beetle.
He's trying to tell you something.
So, anyway, this unconscious stuff, though, has to be dealt with separately. You have to know those skills of how to do that talk with the little ones inside and give them that support. Because you can do all of this on an adult level, but they're not touched. They need special attention. That's why we do that work. It's really critical, actually. Otherwise...
Isn't that primarily validation in a certain way? I mean, isn't that the core of that work, validation? That the little one needs validation?
Well, you can think of, like, with your daughter, there's all kinds of things she needs. But basically, it's that she's loved.
Mm-hmm.
And that she's fine the way she is. She appreciates it.
Yeah. Actually, I watched that. I tracked that. It's very interesting when you have that on board to see, actually to recognize it in the child.
Yeah.
How they respond also to it.
Yeah.
You know, and how that's so familiar to them, that terrain, as if they're kind of married to that emotional wiring.
Yeah, and the child actually... interjects, if we can talk psychologically, but your love for her, you know, like your love for her will go, will be internalized as, you know, that I'm good or I'm fine.
Yeah.
You know, so it internalizes the self-worth and self-esteem.
But
you know, say if you don't get it from the outside, then it's hard to have self-worth and self-esteem on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Because you kind of provide that self-structure for the child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, say you didn't get it. None of us have gotten it perfectly. It's impossible. But you can go in and give it to that part of your psyche, because you can give that unconditional love to the parts inside that don't have it.
What do you say to the psyche where it says that, well, you failed here, or you're insufficient, or you're not adequate, you know, that's...
Well, that voice is kind of the that self-talk is that critical self-talk. And so you have to come in now to replace that critical self-talk and just say, no, you are sufficient, you're a beautiful little boy. You've done a wonder. You've had this difficulty, and look at how beautifully you handled it.
Mm.
You know, you're a special boy. I think you're wonderful, and I love you.
Mm.
Mm. I mean, every child is that way. They're special. They're beautiful as they are.
Mm.
You have to tell that little boy how special he is, and how wonderful he is, and what a cute little fellow he is. I'm completely serious, because that's how you feel towards your child, right? You're the most beautiful thing in the world.
Yeah.
There is no one more better than you.
And you know, what's also interesting is that this age of Mira, you know, where the ego hasn't taken off, you know, it's actually, I can say something really appreciative to her, and it's more like it just goes in. And it just kind of nourishes. You can literally feel it.
Yeah.
It nourishes a part of her soul.
Yeah.
But there's no attitude that comes from it. You know, it's not like, oh yeah, I'm great.
It's like watering a flower. Okay.
Give me more of that. You know, it's like, no, it's like there's a very kind of humble kind of receiving of that takes place. And I think that's kind of really what you're also addressing, that we can do that with ourselves.
Mm, yeah.
And so that humble little being inside of us
gets nourished and becomes okay. It's a miracle, really, the degree that we can solve, that we can heal these wounded parts. Because it's in the imaginal realm.
Mm.
Demons in the imaginal realm of the psyche, so it can be reprogrammed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just theoretical, it's an actuality.
It's an actuality. And in fact, if you address those parts inside, you'll feel the change. You'll feel them responding. So it's worth it to spend doing some of that inner work to, you know. And then the way you are toward yourself is the way you are toward others.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Are we there?
Yeah.